Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Red Fox Blogger. And pardon me, I'm experiencing a little laryngitis this week, but that's okay. Tim and myself, we're going to be discussing the issues of the various Islamic sectors. Please grab yourself a tea, and we'll see you at the beginning of the program in 5 moments.
Practice.
You infidel. You better be apprised of 9:29 because Muhammad said so. Today, Tim and myself, we are going to discuss the issues of various sectors within the Islamica so-called faith. We're not going to go into all 73 of them. There are way too many. But what we want to concentrate on is the issue of the factions and the dissension within them. We're going to concentrate primarily on the Shia and the Sunni and explain to you how the factions came about and all these branches came along. Now, one thing you have to understand about the realm of Islam is that, unlike Christianity, there are factions within it that do not recognize other factions. And as a matter of fact, some factions are considered to be heretics, for example, the Ahmadiyya. So Tim and I, we're going to discuss this with you today, and I apologize for my voice. I have been experiencing laryngitis for the last week, and that's my poor opening to the program. But we are so grateful that you're joining us today, and the co-host, Tim, is right here. Hi, Tim. How are you today?
Well, hello there, Kel. I'm very well, thank you. And how the devil are you tonight?
I'm devilishly terrible. I'm losing my voice.
Oh, that's just what I wanted to hear. I'm very sorry to hear that.
Take it away, Mel. Tim.
Yeah. Oh, this is going to be fun. I tell you what, I was speaking with a colleague of mine on Skype earlier today, a gentleman mm-hmm. from the United States of America. I won't tell you which part, just to spare his blushes. And mm-hmm. he said, "Hey, Tim, I hear you're doing well in this online radio lark." And I said, "Well, yes, Jed." And he said, "Well, what are you going to be talking about tonight?" And I said, "Well, actually, Jed, tonight we're going to be discussing Islamic sects." And there was like silence on the end of the phone. And he said, "God damn, now that's a show I'm going to have to tune into tonight." So I do hope we're not going to disappoint him. Anyway. Yes.
We won't. We're going to be having a lot of a sex tonight. So there you go, Jed.
I may have we're going to have a...
not me and Tim. Tim and... Oh, God. Okay. Audacity time.
Oh, dear.
But yeah, we are going to be discussing the various sectors of Islam, because a lot of people get confused about these sectors. Tim, there's 73 of them out there.
There are indeed, and there are some, let's see. Obviously, there are some big differences between the major sects, but when you look into the differences between the minor sects, the differences seem to be very, very small. Of course, if you actually ever talk to a Muslim from one or other of these sects, you need to be extremely careful, because each one of these sects believes that it and it alone has the true version of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, if there's any dissent or argument, it's out with the knives and Allah Akbar time. So you do have to be a little bit careful with what you say when you talk to them. But yeah, I mean, there's some very, very interesting there's some obscure differences that, and you'd think when you look at some of these sects, you'd think, how do they actually manage to maintain these differences? Because you'd think, well, maybe they'd sit down over a cup of tea and work the differences out, and then they'd be, you know, one sect less to worry about. But no, there's 73 of them, and each of them thinks that they alone have the answer. So that is what keeps things lively in the Islamic world, wouldn't you say, Kel?
I think so. I don't know what it is with them, Tim. They just seem to they can't come to any some sort of reformation, and they the Sunni and the Shiites, when they're fighting amongst themselves, and all these sects they all worship that false prophet Muhammad, but they can't even come to an agreement amongst each other to have peaceful subdivisions within the so-called religion. The Sunni, the Shiite, they hate the Ismaili, for example. They consider them to be heretics. It's just this so-called religion is just left ways, sideways, upside down to Sunday.
Well, just to put things in perspective, if you go back 2,000 years or thereabouts, and you look at the various sects of Judaism, well, the Jewish sects, I should say, that existed around that time, there were, in fact, 72 of those. And I know we're not going to discuss them tonight, and I know that the differences between those various sects, I won't say they've all been fully resolved, but they don't seem to excite the same degree of bloodlust as they do amongst the Muslims. But I suppose it's probably true to say that what they term the major religions. I'm only going to be talking about Jewish religion. Obviously, we're talking about the Islamic sects tonight, and of course, in Christianity, there's all sorts of little minor differences between the various groups there. Obviously, everybody knows about Protestants and Catholics. Most people will have heard of Methodists and Anglicans and so on, and even within groups.
Oh, yeah, and you're bringing up the issue of the sector as well, within the Jewish religion, and there's a lot of problems people have with the Hasidic Jews, and I understand that, because they're rather very Orthodox, and these are the Hasidic Jews. This is the sector that wants women to sit behind the men on the bus and things like that. They're the ones that are walking around with the top hats, and the black jackets and the very 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 long sideburns, so on and so forth. They're very Orthodox, and Judaism, the ones that do follow more equality, shall I say. Well, the ones that are more, help me out here, Tim. The ones that are more, are less Orthodox. The ones that are more engaged in equality, they have a problem with the issue of the Hasidic Judaism. That's a very old sector.
Oh yeah, I mean there are differences. I mean that was the only real point I wanted to say, is that Islam is not alone in being divided into different groups in this way. However, Islam is of particular importance to us, because where you get disagreements between Muslims and non-Muslims, it tends to be problematic, shall we say, for the non-Muslims who have to live in close proximity to devout Muslims, whereas the same is you wouldn't normally say that about living in close proximity to devout Christians or to devout Jews. So, for that reason alone, I think it's worth exploring some of the things that these sects do and don't believe in, and some of the differences and similarities, because when you're talking about Islam, a lot of people will say, well, of course, Islam is not just one monolithic entity, and it's true, there are subtleties and variations, and we should at least be aware of them, even if we can't all quote every single difference and every single similarity in these 73 sects. We ought to just be aware that they exist, and we ought to be able to at least acknowledge where there are differences. Some of them are important, and some of them are less important. But we ought, as non-Muslims, to at least be aware of the fact that they do exist, because the great charge, of course, it's always levied against non-Muslims, and I've had it levied at me several times in the past week, is that us non-Muslims are totally ignorant of Islam, because we don't fully understand all the subtleties and the ins and outs. Now, I would take exception to anybody who says that. It may be true,
yeah,
that we don't learn about Islam in exactly the same way that a Muslim would, for example. I was asked only a week ago about whether I'd actually read the Quran, and I had to quite explain in words of one syllable to the person who was asking me and say, well, I understand it. That's the important thing, because a lot of Muslims, when they a lot of Muslims being born into Islam, which is usually the case, when the time comes for them to actually start learning about Islam and learning about the Quran, quite a lot of Muslims learn it parrot fashion, by first learning Arabic and then learning the Quran in Arabic, parrot fashion, without understanding what it says. And
mm-hmm.
It's not at all uncommon,
exactly,
to come across Muslims who say, very proudly, I've managed to learn the Quran in its entirety by the time I was, 10 or 11 years old. And one of these days, I'm going to save up and buy a translation so that I know exactly what it means. That's quite a common thing to come across. And I was being interrogated on this particular subject, and I said, well, I understand what the Quran is about, even if I don't learn, if I haven't learnt it parrot fashion in English. And therefore, I would argue, who understands more when it comes to the practicalities of Islam? Is it somebody like a Muslim who has learnt the Quran parrot fashion and who is basically taught what to think by an imam in a madrasa or a mosque, or is it somebody like me who's
exactly
looked at different references, and including what we're going to talk about
tonight? The majority of the Muslims, when they are engaging in their five prayers a day, I swear they don't even understand what they're praying about. They are taught by rote what to recite, and one of those passages that they're reciting is "Death to the Infidel," and I'm just loosely saying that.
Well, you're absolutely right. A devout Muslim in his prayers has to curse the Christians and Jews 17 times a day in his prayers, and he may not even realise that's what he's doing, because a devout Muslim will pray in Arabic and not fully understand that according to the prayers that Allah's wrath falls on those I'll have to get the exact translation, but it's those who have lost their way and those who have deliberately left the appropriate path. And it refers to Jews and Christians, and that is effectively a curse on Jews and Christians by devout Muslims 17 times a day, every day, if you're doing your quota of prayers correctly. So yeah, I mean, a lot of Muslims don't even understand that, and therefore, when I'm told that if I want to really learn Islam, I should go to a mosque and learn it from an imam, I have to tactfully and diplomatically beg to differ.
Good luck with all that.
Yes, good luck with that.
Tim, I tell people that if they're heavily invested in learning about the Islam, is do invest in that book, The Reliance of the Traveler. It is a tome. It's very heavy, but it's very, very informative. This person took all the scriptures, the hadiths, the surahs from the Quran, and he translated them into English. Just do yourself a favor. Hey, guess what, Tim? Christmas is coming. Do yourself a favor. Buy yourself a book for yourself and purchase The Reliance of the Traveler, because that is going to be your authorized book, oh, it's just going to be wonderful for you, because I swear, this wonderful book, it really does explain the hadiths and the surahs. I'm glad I have my copy, Tim.
Well, it's certainly a good reference manual. I will say that, and of course, you know, it's handy for propping up the legs of wonky tables.
Oh,
and things like
yeah,
that.
And that's another thing. It's certainly not reading by the fireplace material, but if you have to reference something, that is the manual that you want to have on your desk. On your desk.
It is indeed, yes. I would say if there's any cheapskates out there, I mean, I'm sure that the people listening to this particular radio program, I'm sure there isn't a single cheapskate out there amongst them. But just in case, hypothetically speaking, there was actually a cheapskate out there, it is possible to download The Reliance of the Traveller on PDF off the internet, allegedly. Not that I've got one downloaded here, which I'm looking at the moment, at all. So I'm just saying that in case there's any cheapskates out there who might happen to have dropped in, because I'm sure our regular listeners wouldn't dream of doing such a thing. They would be out at Barnes & Noble or Waterstones or W.H. Smith's here in this country, hammering on the counter and demanding their gold inlaid copy of Reliance of the Traveller forthwith. So there you go.
We have a question from the chat room.
Uh-huh, yeah, far away.
This is from Ken of the Exceptional Conservative Show. He wants to know, is this where he comes to get his lotto tickets to travel to Mecca?
Oh, do you know, I never even thought of putting that as a little sort of PayPal purchase button on the side of my radio show. Wouldn't that be a good idea?
I think that we should set up a PayPal account and we'll put it in our show highlights. What do you think?
That would be an excellent idea. And then when people are in the chat room, they're just waiting for their turn to come onto the show and chat with one or other of us, they can click on the button, get their lotto tickets, and, you know, who knows, you might get a trip for Christmas.
Tim, I've got it. www.com, Worldwide Web, Mecca for You, or something like that.
MeccaForYou.com.
Oh, and Rooster has a question. And Rooster, please do ask a question. And if you want to call in, we're delving into the major sectors of Islam, but the call-in number is 347-237-4318, and you can also Skype in. But we're going to I want to discuss this issue about the Sunni and the Shiite in particular, Tim, because these guys have been going at it since the usurper died in the year 632, because the Sunni, they make up about 85% of the Islamic world, and they claim to be the direct continuation of the faith as defined by Muhammad. For many years, they acknowledged the religious authority of a ruling caliph, the major point of contention with the breakaway Shiite movement. And now the Sunni, they derive their name through reliance on the Sunnah, or the observed sayings, lifestyle, and practices of Muhammad. And that was as recorded in a collection of writings called the Hadith. The Sunni accept the Sunnah as the source of spiritual wisdom, while the Shiite insist on the primacy of the Quran. And the Shiite, they've been going back and forth with the Sunni since 632, because that's the smaller of the two principal branches of Islam. The Shiite, they account for at least 10% of all Muslims. They originally were followers of the fourth caliph, who was Ali, who was Muhammad's son-in-law, and through the prophet's daughter, Fatima. So Ali claimed that Muhammad, on his deathbed, selected Ali as leader of the faith, but Ali was murdered during the fifth year of his reign. So the Shiite firmly broke away from the Muslim leaders recognized by the Sunni around 680. Now, a principal belief of the Shiite is that there is no caliph since Ali. The movement became popular amongst disaffected non-Arab Muslims who feared that they were held in lower esteem within the faith. And that's really important, Tim, is that the Shiite are non-Arabic.
Yes, indeed. And as you say, they refer to successors after the prophet as being the ones to follow, and they don't agree at all with the Sunni principles of the four rightly guided caliphs, as they're called. Of course, in Sunni Islam, anybody who is a devout Muslim and who is duly elected by the appropriate process, whatever that may be, could be said to become a caliph. But that's not the case in Shia Islam, because it's supposed to be a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad who is one of the infallible imams, or who is sufficiently qualified in order to lead that branch of Shia Islam. Place where we've most recently heard most about Shia Islam, of course, is Iran. There's a lot of Shia Muslims in Iran, and I dare say you're all familiar with the former president, Ahmadinejad, who famously said that peace and justice will come when the 12th imam is revealed.
Muhammad al-Mahdi.
When he comes out of the world and dispenses peace and justice, and that will come when there is that there'll be necessarily some sort of apocalyptic event prior to that, which of course is something that should trouble us all, because Iran is in the process of getting itself a nuclear weapon, despite what everybody, all the politicians in the United States are trying to tell us about how they're not really trying to go for a nuclear weapon at all, and the Iranians themselves who say, well, yes, we might be enriching uranium, but it's peaceful uranium, and you shouldn't worry about it. So
it's not peaceful at all. It's not peaceful uranium at all. What they're doing is Obama's deal heard around the world is that they are restricting themselves from enriching from something like 5% to 2% or something like that, but they still have capabilities.
Indeed, yes. They've got the capability very quickly to bring it up to weapons grade.
Yeah.
And when I said peaceful uranium, I was, in fact, employing a little degree of sarcasm, which is something that some of your listeners may have noticed that
I
employ from time to time. From time to time, I do employ a little bit of sarcasm every now and then. So, because you've got a sect in Iran that believes these things and is also well on the way to developing a nuclear bomb, of course, that should bother us all. But it is worth knowing that they're not just a minor offshoot or an extremist offshoot of mainstream Islam at all. As Kel said, they make up at least 10% of the total Islamic population. And when you've got a total population throughout the world of about 1.4 billion, 10% corresponds to, let's say, 200 million, shall we say, as a round figure. That's still a lot of people. If they all believe, if they don't all live in Iran, I should say, the geographical geographical split is throughout Islamic world, although they are a minority in most countries. Iran is one country where they're not a minority. But yes, when you've got a combination of such religious fervor that's dependent on an apocalypse happening sometime in the near future, together with advanced nuclear technology, it should be something that concerns us all. But I don't want to get in too much on that side of it. I think I'd just like to say at the moment that they have these beliefs, and they do differ from Sunni Islam in quite a lot of details, and those are details which we should at least be aware of. And I hope that by the time we finish the program tonight, people will go away with a somewhat greater appreciation of the various differences. You could devote an entire I say university course, postdoctorate course, you could, and I'm sure there are
people
who devote their entire lives to studying these differences.
Yeah.
So we are restricting ourselves to an overview at this stage in the proceedings. We only have a couple of hours, but nevertheless, we hope you'll find it informative.
And one thing I do want to share with the listeners is that Iran is at the point where they have 20% uranium for its medical needs, so we are told. And the deal heard around the world is that they would cut that back to about 5%. My apologies, I quoted 5% to 2%, but that is still scary in itself, because they can take these isotopes and they can put them somewhere. They can do what Iraq did during the war when they were invading. I'm losing my mind here because.
Sorry, I was scrolling down while you were saying that. You were talking about. Sorry, just say that last bit again, if you would, please, Kel.
When they were invading Kuwait, Saddam Hussein decided to invade Kuwait, it was that's when the United States got involved, and the United States was accusing Saddam Hussein of hiding weapons of mass destruction, Saddam Hussein, no, I'm not doing that. That's what I'm thinking, and that that brought on the Iraq War because they went into Kuwait. Well, we all are pretty much familiar with the idea that Iraq actually smuggled out his weapons of mass destruction and held them in Syria. And now we're seeing this in Iran, and that they're saying, no. Our isotopes, they're for peaceful purposes, and we're not going to do anything with them. Barack Hussein Obama is totally buying into that.
Yes. I think that Barack Hussein Obama is totally out of his depth when it comes to Middle Eastern politics.
Yeah.
And he's being played like a cheap violin, to be quite honest.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say being played by a Stradivarius, but that would be rather insulting to Stradivarii all around the
that
world.
That would be
so
totally insulting violin. To the Cat Indeed. Strangler.
Yeah, well, quite. I'm not even going to go there tonight, Kel. Oh, all right, then, if you insist. Just in case for any of you listeners out there who don't know, my nickname of Cat Strangler was given to me, not because I strangle cats, but because my mother disliked the sound of my violin playing when I was about 10 or 11 years old. And she said, it sounds like you're strangling cats. So I thought I'd better throw that in just in case anybody's still wondering about it. But
people don't want to be friends with you because they think you you're a future serial killer.
I get this all the time. I get people who say, I would like to follow you on Twitter, but I'm afraid to in case you come around and strangle my cat. So I have to give them this story. And I've got quite fluent at telling this story in various forms over time. So, anything to entertain your listeners, Kel. That's what I say. But, back to what I was saying.
No, it's our listeners.
Obama. Barack Hussein Obama.
Yes.
I
abhor Obama's deal with Iran. I think this is a very bad move. And getting back to what we were discussing is that I think that he's supportive of the majority of Sunni, in my opinion. And even the Shia, And that sector is under threat. These Islamic sectors, they're very, very dangerous people. But one thing that you have to understand is that the Sunni and the Shia, they have been at each other's throats since 632. But they fight amongst themselves. When they're not busy killing themselves, they're killing us. This is a madcap political ideology. It's just crazyism.
Well, it is, and the reason we hear so much about it, of course, is because between them, they make up the majority of Muslims out there. But when they're not at each other's throats, they do, of course, find other sects within Islam to persecute. And I'm sure you've heard of the Ahmadiyya sect, which is they don't believe, the Ahmadiyya don't believe that the Prophet Muhammad was the final prophet at all. And they believe that they follow a different prophet altogether who lived relatively recently,
mm-hmm.
A chap by the name of Hazrat Mirza Ghulam Ahmed of Qadian. And he lived from around about 1835 to 1908. And they believe that he is the promised Messiah. And because of this, most other Muslims, in fact, all other Muslims of all the other 72 sects have got together universally and declared the Ahmadiyya to be not Muslims at all. And that was as recently, I think, as 1974. And it was quite widely published in the Islamic world that all the other Muslims had pretty much agreed as a group that they were going to excommunicate, for want of a better word, the Ahmadiyya.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, they're talking about, I don't know if this is just in Pakistan, but there was a newspaper article from September 1974 in The Guardian which said that the National Assembly, which I presume means the National Assembly of Pakistan, has stripped 500,000 members of the Ahmadiyya community of their religious status as Muslims. And they do actually use the word excommunication. That is stated to be a unique event in the 1,400 years of the history of Islam, because previously, although there were 73 sects and although they used to kick seven shades of whatever out of each other over time whenever they had the opportunity, they never actually got to the point of excommunicating such mm-hmm. a large number of Muslims in one go as they did with the Ahmadiyya. And of course, ever since then, the Ahmadiyya have been persecuted in every Islamic country they happen to find themselves in. And we see, well, those of us who follow publications such as the religionofpeace.com or jihadwatch.com.
For goodness sake, yes, all these counter-jihadist sites, my goodness, people, you have to put these in your bookmarks, in your drop-down menus. And, hey, Tim, we have a caller mm-hmm. that wants to join us.
Okay.
Evil Rooster, and he is a fellow conservative radio host right here on Block Talk Radio.
Okay.
And he wants to join in the conversation. Rooster!
Well, first, Kel, I wanted to thank you personally for the other night. I'm a virgin blogger, sir, or radio host, so to speak, and you really helped me out. And actually, it was a good segue because who was it, Luchador, I think, excommunicated me from Christianity the other day simply because of my name.
Oh, goodness sake. No, Rooster, it was my absolute pleasure to I went there as a listener, and I saw the trouble that you were in. I'm glad that you invited me and trusted me with your passwords to help you out. It was my absolute pleasure, Rooster. Absolute pleasure.
Yeah.
What do you think about the topic of today that Tim and myself are discussing? As a layperson, I'm a layperson. I mean, I'm a counter-jihadist.
Uh-huh.
I'm still a layperson. What do you think about Islam and how it's affecting the Western world?
Well, you know, and I'll bring up a point that we talked about on my show the other night. There are different flavors mm-hmm. of conservatism.
Yeah.
I personally don't have a grudge against Muslims. Now, and it's important to point out that Muslims
we don't. That's the thing. There is no grudge against Muslims whatsoever. It's the issue of Islam that we're battling. Absolutely. The ideology.
And I have issues with radical Islam,
mm-hmm.
the ones that want to blow me up. I do agree with your host that our pansy in chief is a bit over his head when it comes to Mideast policy. And quite frankly, he's a bit over his head when it comes to all policy. But I'm wondering now what they're going to do when Israel lights the fuse in the Middle East, because they can't have a nuclear Iran. It just cannot happen. Israel cannot stand for that because they know what they will do.
Exactly. And that's the thing, that if Iran does get the bomb, as it were, and this is pretty much a deal that Barack Hussein Obama made with them, that if they're going to continue with their enrichment programs, and Iran is going to, first of all, gun for Israel. Israel will have no choice but to react. That is quite frightening.
Yeah, and if I were Saudi Arabia, if I were Saudi Arabia, I'd be asking for United States to put troops on the border right now, because and we discussed this on another show the other night. That's where Iran's going to look next. I mean, you've already got proxies of Iran in Syria and Iraq.
Exactly. I want Tim to respond to that. Tim, take it away.
Yes, okay. First of all, good evening to you, Rooster. Oh,
Rooster.
Good afternoon, I imagine, because you're still mid-afternoon over there.
Yes.
Good of you to join us. And yes, as you say, with this particular political situation, it's getting very, very dangerous, because Israel is being backed into a corner because Obama is pursuing, in my view, if not actually a suicidal course, he's pursuing a course which is going to result in millions of unnecessary deaths. And I am absolutely sure you're right when you say that Israel cannot possibly countenance a nuclear Iran, and for the simple reason that the Shia sect that we're talking about believes absolutely that by unleashing a holocaust of the nature that a nuclear explosion in downtown Tel Aviv would bring, they're hastening the return of the 12th Imam. And that is a terrifying prospect, I imagine, if you happen to be in Israel right now, knowing that people who hold those views are so close to developing a nuclear capability that will inflict, well, serious damage is an understatement, be catastrophic for Israel. So I agree entirely that Israel is being backed into a corner where it will have, in the very near future, no alternative if it doesn't get some assistance, diplomatic assistance, very strong diplomatic assistance from the United States, which doesn't look like it's going to be forthcoming under Barack Hussein Obama. Israel will be forced into a position where it'll have to act unilaterally, much as it doesn't want to, because of the belief that this particular sect of Islam holds. And it's not just the people in the street, it's people right at the top level in all the key political and military positions that hold these views. So, yes, I agree entirely with you.
But
Rooster, thank you so very much for your comment. I want you to wrap up your comment. We have another caller who wants to join us.
Okay.
And Rooster, you have your final say, and thank you so very much. Go ahead.
Okay, real quick, I don't think that Iran really knows what they're putting Israel into. And if you think back to the Six-Day War, Israel struck first. And Israel will strike first this time. And one other quick comment. I heard you guys talking about Saddam Hussein earlier. Saddam Hussein was not Islamic. He didn't find Islam until...
No, I have never, ever agreed with invading Iraq. I have always held my opinion that was a grievous mistake. And after the towers fell in 2001, that where we should have gone was to the source, and that was Afghanistan. Iraq was a casualty of an American war, as far as I'm concerned. So, Rooster, you and I absolutely agree with that. Rooster, I adore you. I'm going to put you on mute because Tim and myself, we want to bring in another person right now. If you would like to sit with us, you're more than welcome.
I'll listen to you on speaker. My kids are coming home, so I've got to leave it at that. But I
there
did want to say
go.
Thank you. Thank you again for the other
yep.
night.
Good talking to you,
Rooster.
Hope to speak to you again sometime soon.
Okay.
And we have Tim. We have Sue uh-huh. from New Mexico, and she wants to share
excellent.
With us. Sue, hi.
Hi, Carol. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Sue.
You know,
how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Love your show. Wanted to respond to something that Rooster said about putting U.S. troops on the border and troops being over in the Middle East. As long as Obama is president, I do not think that should happen. Obama's with the Muslim Brotherhood, the terrorists who are killing our troops. He ties their hands. Casualties have gone up more during Obama's reign than any other time. And I do not want our troops over there as long as Obama is calling the shots. And that's all
exactly.
I wanted to say. Thank you.
Sue, I can agree with that 110%. This man scares me. This man is leading the United States of America. This man is reducing the greatest nation on the planet, the superpower, the one that the rest of the Western world relies on, into a third world state with his ideology. Sue, I pray for my American cousins.
Oh, thank you. It's frightening, totally frightening, but I pray for our troops, too, and the ones who are still
yeah.
over there. What
yeah,
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And Tim,
uh-huh.
Tim and I, we had a conversation a little while back about, I was interviewing a soldier in which he said that, when we're deployed, we're there until the job is done. The job is never going to be done. And Tim, you were discussing about why should we be sending them there in the first place? And share with Sue your thoughts about that, Tim.
Yes, well, I totally agree that it would be disastrous to get into a deepening Middle East conflict while we've got somebody like Obama, while the United States, I should say, has somebody like Obama at the helm. In his presidency, he's shown himself in pretty much every important political decision to be on the wrong side. And by the wrong side, what I mean is that his decisions have the effect of weakening America internally or weakening American influence worldwide. So given that track record, and that's in a position of, shall we say, relative global harmony, even though we are involved in hot wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, I'm talking about, relatively speaking, this is a period of peace. This is a period that we may well look back on in a year or 2 years' time and think, wasn't it wonderful back in 2013 when we didn't have worldwide nuclear global conflict? But once that breaks out, I agree with you entirely, Sue. Obama is not the right man to be at the head of any kind of military force which is tasked with taking the right decisions and putting things right, the things that have gone wrong. So I can only hope that if such a scenario breaks out, and quite honestly, I hope it doesn't. I hope there are diplomatic methods that can be found to avoid the kind of conflict that I see coming down the road. But in the event that that doesn't happen, I agree with you entirely that Obama is completely the wrong person to have at the helm when that sort of conflict needs to be managed. So, yes, all we can really do is pray that it doesn't happen. But if the worst comes to the worst, we'd better pray extra hard because Obama is, I'm sure, going to continue his pattern of taking totally the wrong decisions for the benefit of America. So, there we go. I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad tidings in that respect. I wish I could have some upbeat news. I really do, because I feel deeply for our brothers and sisters in America. I'm not an American myself. I have spent time in America, and the people I've met over there have been the most wonderful people you could ever wish to meet. But I do feel for them because they are being led into. What I can't see anything I could really say positive at this moment, except if by a miracle Obama is removed from office. I know it seems unlikely at the moment, but if that were to happen and he was replaced by a strong leader with conservative principles, well, maybe there's a way back from that. But at the moment, it's looking difficult, and I wish I could say something better. But all I can do is pray for you guys, brothers and sisters. So that's probably all I should say, because otherwise I'm going to just make everybody totally miserable for the rest of the show, and I didn't really intend for that to happen.
Oh, Tim, that's beautifully said, eh, Sue?
Oh, yes, and, you know, at least in the UK, Cameron was leading your troops down the same path, but at least your parliament stood up. And that's all I can hope Congress will do. Thank you both so very much.
Yeah, you're welcome, Sue. Oh, thanks for calling
Sue.
In.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is always an honor to hear your voice on EDL Radio and the Red Fox Blogger. Always, Sue. Thank you so very much.
You're welcome. I'm just going to listen now. Thank you.
Okay, I'll put you back on listen. And that was our lovely Sue from New Mexico. Ladies and gentlemen, this woman works tirelessly to share the programs that we strive to bring to you. Sue works so hard. I swear, this woman is my twin in which we don't sleep. And it's called citizen journalism. And I'm proud to be part of that. I am haltingly speaking sometimes, and now I'm speaking with a lisp because I had dental surgery about 7 months ago, and the front tooth is still to be shaved back, which will not occur until February. So isn't that ironic, Tim? I have dental surgery, and now I talk like this all the time.
Well,
and I'm a radio host.
Well, if you don't mind me saying, Kel, it's part of your attractiveness on the radio waves. You do have such a melodic and attractive voice, as I may have said before. And Kel's not paying me to say this, ladies and gentlemen. I'm actually saying it from the heart. I think she's got a beautiful voice, and I think she's ideally suited to being a radio host. And the fact that she's got a lisp, in my view, makes her only more endearing to the rest of us. And I'm sure there's a lot of listeners out there who would agree with me. So don't worry too much about that, Kel. Every cloud has a silver lining. That's what I say.
Oh, thank you, Tim. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I gave Tim his Christmas bonus early so that he would say that. Just kidding. But we are talking about the Sunni, like the issues between the factions within the Islamic realm. And Tim, I came across this clip, and I thought it was rather interesting. And this is Sunni versus Shia. I think I'll play that right now and get your opinion about it when we come back.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, this clip is 4 minutes and 20 seconds. We will see you back here in 4 minutes and 20 seconds. Take a listen to this, and Tim and myself will come back and discuss it. Anytime. Come on. Be a good boy.
Well, Sunni and Shia Muslims have a shared past that goes back all the way to the Prophet Muhammad, and the real dispute is over, ironically, something that is a, should have happened. And so what I mean is that when the Prophet died, the community asked who should take over his leadership and who should sort of be at the head of this new political community that existed, because you have to remember that at the time of the Prophet's death, you have a political structure that governs the entire Arabian Peninsula, that is both the religion and the state at the time. And so the Shiites felt that his son-in-law and first cousin, Ali ibn Abu Talib, should have succeeded the leadership position. And they feel that he was ousted and that he was sort of sidelined. The Sunni Muslims believe that what happened historically should have happened, and that is that one of the Prophet Muhammad's top lieutenants, Abu Bakr, who was a sort of hardcore supporter of the Prophet from the very earliest days of his message and of his mission, he took over the reins of the community. And after about another two leaders, then Ali took over. He was the fourth successor. And so it's a little bit ironic that this historical difference that has existed for the last, you know, 1400 years, in fact, really comes down to a, what should have happened over history. Now, what happened is, and what happened, what people believe happened, is pretty hard for the historian to figure out. But for us today, what's important is that we know that Sunni Islam becomes sort of the religion of the masses of the Muslim world. And so today, 85% or so of the Muslim world identify themselves as Sunni Muslims, and they see themselves as a linear kind of historical community all the way from the time of the Prophet Muhammad to the present, that they embody his mission and his message. For Sunni Muslims, the history of the community as a whole takes on a very important sort of imaginary symbol. That is the community of the worldwide Muslims, the early sort of polity, the conquests, and the rapid spread of Islam around the world. These are all things that Sunni Muslims value as a testament to you know, the greatness of Islam. Shiite Muslims, on the other hand, could care much less about sort of the imperial politics of Islam or the manifestation of Islam as a, you know, global political entity. Instead, Shiites care much more about the family of the Prophet Muhammad, and that is sort of the spiritual charisma that the Prophet's family holds, both his immediate family and the descendants of that family. For an outsider of the tradition, you wouldn't be able to recognize the way in which Shiites pray differently than Sunnis and Sunnis vice versa. You wouldn't be able to find, for example, an extra Quran or a different Quran. And so it's very hard to figure out what it is that they're actually arguing over. The differences in ritual praxis are very, very, you know, small and minor. What affects not the day-to-day, but the ritual calendar is really what matters more in these differences. So Shiites commiserate, they don't celebrate, but they commiserate a tragedy that happened in an Iraqi city called Karbala, and Karbala is often in the news these days for a site of, you know, site of sectarian conflict and whatnot. Well, Karbala was the site where Hussein, who was the son of Ali, therefore the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, was murdered by an early sort of imperial Islamic dynasty, a monarch, who was at that time not Sunni. There wasn't Sunni or Shiite at any time at this time in history. There was just simply conflicting groups that saw politics and religion as one. And so Hussein, along with his family, they were slaughtered there. And every year, and actually we're in that moment right now, every year during the first month of Muharram, which is the Islamic New Year for Shiites, or for Muslims in general, Muharram is the month where, you know, the new calendar begins. The first 10 days mark the commiseration of what they call Ashura, and that becomes a reenactment, a replay of what Hussein went through during that battle.
And that is very, very fascinating and very interesting. I hope that gives you a bit of an insight about the difference between the two principal factions of Islam, and that is the Sunni and the Shia. What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, that was quite succinctly put. I listened to that clip with great interest, and as the gentleman said, you've got on the one side the Sunni Muslims care very much about the conquest and the history and the politics of Islam and what made Islam great and allowed for its expansion and so on, whereas the Shia Muslims care much more about the spiritual side of things and the relationship of the family.
Yeah.
And the charisma that the family enjoys through its descendants and so on. And, of course, one of the things that springs to mind is when the United States was getting in more deeply involved in the Middle East in recent years, one of the let me think. Her name was Rice, and I always get confused between Susan Rice and Condoleezza Rice. And I'm sure it was one rather than the other.
Do you mean the former Secretary of State of the United States?
It could be.
Whichever one I quote,
probably going to be the other one. But she was asked about what are we going to do about this conflict between the Sunnis and the Shias? And she famously said, they're just going to have to get over that. As if she could dispense with 1,400 years of conflict in a single sentence like that. And it brought home to me the fact that the United States should be extremely careful when it meddles in the Middle East without fully understanding the history and the politics and so on. In fact, sometimes I think that people like us on these shows understand 10 times more about the history and the politics and the things that have gone on within Islam to bring it to the point where it is today, then all these foreign policy advisors and these secretaries of state and so on in recent years in the United States and probably in the UK and other Western countries as well. I rather think that people like us who've done a little bit of research to bring you these shows on Blog Talk Radio actually understand more. When you get people who totally misread the situation because they haven't bothered doing their research into the history and politics of something as complex as the Middle East, when they totally misread the situation and then go in to make decisions that are going to affect millions of lives, well, if I had that responsibility, I'd be working damn hard to make sure I could make the best decision possible rather than one that just looked good on paper and maybe helped to, get my party re-elected. I would hope I would think deeper than that. But there again, I'm an idealist, not a politician. So there we go. But yes, that was an interesting...
I really admired Condoleezza Rice for her stance on that. And just to let people know that I'm very, very biased because she's one of my heroes. I had been following this lady's career for so many years. When she served that office of the Secretary of State and was the second highest person to hold that office beside President George W. Bush, and her statements about Islam, they were heartwarming. We miss these politicians. We miss these politicians. And the thing is that, Tim, we're sitting here and we're dealing with these factions and they're fighting amongst themselves. But one thing they do, Tim, is that they all of a sudden get rather quiet when they're fighting the infidel. I am so sick and tired of the, more Muslims kill more Muslims than they kill infidels. But, hey, it's like a pack of dogs, okay? It's, we're going to have a rumble, and then there's a lone little kitty cat over there. Oh, okay, let's attack the cat. That's Islam.
Yeah. Well, it is. And while you've been talking, I've just double-checked statement that came out from the Secretary of State, and it was Condoleezza Rice. Mm. I don't know why I was thinking of Susan Rice, but it was Condoleezza Rice.
She's the one who banned Pamela Geller or Robert Spencer.
Well, could be. Well... The point is that it was back in January 2007, and she was speaking about the conflict in the Middle East, and she said, there's still a tendency to see these things in Sunni/Shia terms, but the Middle East is going to have to overcome that, which I can't help but feel was a little simplistic. So whatever her good attributes, and I suppose, to be fair, for somebody like that to rise to the position that she has, I wouldn't necessarily say that she's 100% bad, but I do think that sometimes a little bit more research into the history and politics of the places that you happen to be going into invading that week wouldn't go amiss. But like I say, I'm an idealist and not a politician. But there you go.
And there you go. What are we to do with this political ideology? These factions within it, I don't even want to use the word factions. It's fractured. They're fractured. There are 73 different sects in it, and they are fractured. They can't even get along with each other. They were so upset about a Sunni in Iraq, and then just unbelievable. It's like they slow down, but like I was referring, they come back and they turn their backs like the scourge. I refer to them as Kurd dogs. The Kurd dogs, they slow down and they turn around and look over their mangy shoulders and they see an infidel. It's like, okay, guys, we're going to stop fighting amongst each other, but we're going for the infidel. But this issue of the Sunni and the Shia in particular, that one really is distressing because they also introduce all sorts of other sectors. And Wahhabism is wow.
Oh yeah, I was going to get onto that, but just before I do, I mean, you remind me of an Arab phrase. Well, I say it's an Arab phrase. It's one that's well known in the Middle East, and although I don't know it in Arabic or Persian, it goes like this: myself against my brother, my brothers and I against our cousins, the people in our village against the next village, but all of us against the infidel. And you're absolutely right that they will put aside their differences when it comes to overcoming the infidel. And one of the things to remember is that no matter how much we might go into analyzing the various different sects on a show like tonight's show, that when it comes to doing practical things in order to deal with the Islamic encroachment into the West and the advance of Islam in our societies, it doesn't help us at that point when we're deciding what practical things to do. This knowledge that we're imparting tonight won't necessarily help in that fight, because we are going to have to deal with Muslims of whatever sect who will band together to fight the infidel. So although it's helpful to know these things, they are of less importance when it comes to practical things that we can do to fight against that encroachment. And of course, if you want to know a little bit more about the steps that we can take to fight against that encroachment, I suggest you you have a listen to another blog talk radio show when you have an hour or so to spare, and that's Liberty GB. I highly recommend it, but I won't go into...
Oh, absolutely, and so do I. And as a matter of fact, I have a link for people to go and listen to that. You know what, Tim? I want you to expand on your latest endeavors when... you are involved with Liberty GB with Paul Weston. Please explain to the listeners what you're doing. It's wonderful.
Yeah, okay. I don't want to give everybody the impression that I'm just promoting this particular blog talk radio show. I've been invited to host the fledgling Liberty GB radio show, which Kel will put a link into the chat room for you to listen. One of the things we've been discussing is how we might remove Islam from, in particular, Britain, and by extension, also hopefully from Europe. now, it's not the sort of thing that it's going to happen overnight. And what
on the
shows so far is just talk about various possibilities. And if you also look at the if you look at the articles on the Liberty GB website itself, which is libertygb.org, I think I'll have to double check. Kel will maybe find that and stick it in the chat room while I'm talking. But you will find that there are some practical things that we can all think about, because this is not, in my view, an unwinnable fight. A lot of people say to me, well, there's so many Muslims in Britain and in Europe and in Western countries, you know, there's no possible way that we can do anything about it. Well, I beg to differ. There's a lot we can do. Admittedly, it will take political willpower, which is not there at the moment. But we have elections coming up in the UK in 18 months' time, and 18 months is a long time in politics, so there are things that we can do. But the most important thing, first and foremost, is to make people aware, first of all, that we have a problem, secondly, that it's not an insurmountable problem, and thirdly, how we can best do it with the minimum amount of bloodshed. Because let's face it, if we don't do anything about it at all and things continue as they are, we're all going to have a horrendous mess to deal with. And I'm not just talking about people like myself of my generation. My children, our children, our grandchildren are going to have to pick up the pieces. So we owe it to them to do whatever we can to make sure that doesn't come about. There are ways, in my view, that it could be we could turn the tide on what's happening. And although this isn't the show necessarily to discuss those particular things at this time, if you have a look at the Liberty GB website and listen to the Blog Talk Radio broadcast from a day or so ago, you'll hopefully get some extra ideas that you can think about before we come back and talk to you next week. But that's it in a nutshell, Kel. But what I wanted to just before you go,
brilliant,
before Kel, what I wanted to say was, when we're talking about the various sects of Islam, and I was saying, in order to fight this fight, we don't necessarily need to know about all the differences in order to fight the fight that needs to be fought. There was a time in not in living memory, we're going back a few hundred years ago, where knowing the differences between the various sects of Islam was extremely important for certain colonial powers. And in particular, I'm thinking about the British plans for expansion back in the 1700s. Now, it's not widely known, but the British had the British politicians of those times tended to think a lot further ahead than British politicians do today.
Yeah.
And despite all the shortcomings, shall we say, I mean, it's very difficult when you're talking about what politicians should have done. It's always very difficult to predict the future. But one of the things that struck me when I was researching this was how far ahead they thought. And back in the 1700s, they felt that the Ottoman Empire was something that should be made to crumble from within. Probably not so very different from the way the Muslim Brotherhood thinks when it looks at Western society today. It looks at the way our democracies work, identifies weaknesses, and then does what it can to attack it from every way possible. And what we are starting to see, or what we've started to see in the last 15, 20 years, is the extent to which they have infiltrated and they have been successful in what they've done. Up to now, up to relatively recently, a lot of the political elites and the various intelligence groups and so on didn't really have a clear idea as to what people like the Muslim Brotherhood were actually up to. I mean, they knew that it was their purpose to advance Islam, but they didn't know until documents were discovered during a raid back in 1990s, early 2000s.
Yeah, it was back in when they discovered the declaration, and I think they discovered a copy in the Netherlands, I believe, and they discovered another copy in the United States, and I believe that was here. Let me see. I'm going to bring that up.
Okay. Well, while you're looking at that, the point I was getting onto is that trying to divide a society from within and attack it from within is not necessarily a new idea. And back in the 1700s, the research I've been doing suggests that the British were very active in trying to destroy the Ottoman Empire from within. They'd done quite a lot of research, and they reckoned that the Ottoman Empire had a lot of weak points, and they dispatched, according to the documents I've seen anyway, I don't know. There's probably a little bit of poetic license in there, but they dispatched a number of spies to the Middle East to foment discontent and to cause divisions amongst the Islamic community. And one of the things they did, and I'll bring up the link in a moment and post it in the chat room for you, if this document is to be believed, one of the things they did was to encourage the growth of Wahhabism in order to sow division amongst Muslims in the Middle East.
Here we go, Tim. Okay. Yeah, what was disclosed and ladies and gentlemen, this was found in a sub-basement, and this was the 50-point plan manifesto. And this, of course, was written by Hassan al-Banna, founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. This is what he had in mind for the West. And this is what Tim is discussing and I'm discussing. These people have, these Quranimals, they have designs. And they're infiltrating us. They are doing it with civilization jihad.
Yes, indeed. And I was, the point of my little story is it's not necessarily a new thing that the British, and here's the link that I've been looking at. The British exploited the divisions of tried to sow discord and discontent amongst Muslims by introducing a new sect called Wahhabism. They cultivated a chap who's called, I think, Ibn Wahhab. I'll have to get his full name. It's within that article I've just posted. Anyway,
brilliant.
The idea was that he would develop new ideas relating to Islam and promote them as if it was the one true way of practicing Islam. And in fact, if it's true, it just goes to show you have to be extremely careful with what you do, because some of these ideas may come back and bite you in the behind. Because
Wahhabism,
of course, is one of the most virulent strains of Islam that we see today, and is the strain that's being exported all around the world using the money from Saudi Arabian oil, and it's arguably a source of a lot of the problems that we see, that our civilization and our political elites seem very, I won't say clueless. Yes, no, I will say clueless. They're clueless. They don't understand.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, Tim. Absolutely.
So clueless, yes, that's the word. But again, another thing, if you've got an hour or two to spare, have a look at that link that I've posted on the chat room, Confessions of a British Spy. It's in PDF form. I'm very fond of PDFs because it means you don't have to go to Amazon and spend a lot of your hard-earned money.
No, you don't. Yeah.
No, if you've got a PDF on the internet, you can just download it and read it at your leisure.
See?
This is why
we adore you. You bring something to the table, and every time you're on the air, you bring something to the table, and you just brought free stuff to the table.
Free stuff.
So the listeners appreciate that.
Not only are you entertained, are you entertained?
There you go. I was going to ask you, though, you probably we are down to close to our last 40 minutes, and I want, though, for you to refresh your tea and for our listeners to refresh theirs. And I've got myself an issue here in my office, and Freya, Mama's working. Come on. Gee. So what do you say about a four-minute break?
I say that's hardly enough time to deal with a saber-toothed tiger, Kel, but you being the kind of I'm sure you'll manage admirably.
Bless you. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, Tim and myself, we are going to take a break, and we are going to see you back here in 4 minutes. I want you to enjoy some, well, I want you to enjoy, I don't know if Tim does. Oh, I'm sure Tim does too, because this
of
guy
course.
Is a good guy. And this is Eric Clapton, Tim.
Hey, excellent.
There you go. We'll see you back here, like Tim and myself said, in 4 minutes, guys. Refresh your teeth. Don't be late. And welcome back, everybody, to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Tim Burton and Carol Fritzi. And I apologize that I've managed to contract a cold, it would seem, and it's giving me laryngitis as well. A lot of people are saying, I hope that laryngitis hangs around, baby, but I hope it doesn't. But Tim has been doing a lot of heavy lifting for this little Foxy today, and I appreciate Tim for that. We are discussing the issue of the Islamic sectors, and we're not going through 73 because otherwise we would bore you to death. Oh, Islam, they don't like to bore you to death. They want to kill you to death. But Tim was, we're moving into something a little different. That we're down to our last 30 minutes of talking points. But Tim is going to discuss with you the article that he was sharing, and that is the issue of Wahhabism. And something you have to understand, Wahhabism, it's been posing a great threat for 250 years. Wahhabism is very, very much, they consider themselves a purist sect of Islam. And I want Kat, my cat, meow, I want Tim to expand on that.
Yes, well, the what Kel's referring to actually is elaborated on an article from the Tehran Times, which that's Tehran as in the capital of Iran, and an article was posted there earlier this year by an Iranian, Mohammed Safizadeh. Who wrote about Wahhabism and in terms where he himself considered it to be a threat to Islamic civilization. And he's obviously read the same articles that I've been looking at with the Confessions of the British Spy. And he thinks that it's all the fault, of course, of the perfidious British, the fact that we've got this problem with Wahhabism in the first place. Well, okay, what the British did or didn't do 300 years ago may or may not be completely outlined in the PDF that I've sent to you. I think it's an interesting document. I think there are maybe certain things in it that need to be taken with a pinch of salt, and I certainly don't think it's entirely the fault of the British that we have the problem with Wahhabism mm-hmm. that we do today. But it wouldn't surprise me at all, as with many things that I read on the internet, if there wasn't an element of truth in it. Wahhabism, of course, has been promoted extensively by Saudi Arabia, as I said just before the break, due to Saudi petrodollars. And it's a sad fact that oil was discovered in Saudi Arabia virtually by accident back in the 1930s. The people who discovered oil were actually drilling for water, and they came across oil, and the rest is history. It made Saudi Arabia very, very rich, at which point they felt that it was appropriate for whatever a reason to push Wahhabism around the world. And with the oil money that they had to do that with, they've been wildly successful. And we've only recently begun to understand the implications of Wahhabism and the dangers of Islam to the extent that we have. That's a story that could take up another complete show. So I'm only going to sort of touch on the Saudi Arabia connection briefly there, as I did on the British connection just before the break. But just to say that that it is Wahhabism is tied in with another sect of Islam called the Salafi movement, and of course people who've been following the events of the Arab Spring throughout North Africa and the Middle East will recognize the term Salafi, because it was the mm-hmm. Salafis that were pushing for the predominant positions, particularly in Egypt and Tunisia. They saw the Arab Spring as being a springboard, if you like, for mm-hmm. them to gain power in those countries, and they very nearly succeeded in Egypt until they were ousted by the the Egyptian military, and I wouldn't even think that the problem is by any means over in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood now have between their teeth, and Salafism, I'm sure, will rear its ugly head again. But Salafism and Wahhabism are actually quite closely tied together, and if you look at what Salafis actually read and what they believe, they do refer back to Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab, the chap who's mentioned quite extensively in that document, a PDF document I put in the chat room.
Oh, yes.
They do actually refer to him, and they reference his works frequently. So, although they do consider Salafi followers, Salafiya, as they're called, they consider it, they don't like to be called Wahhabis. That's like a derogatory term. If you're talking to a Salafi and you refer to him as a Wahhabi, well, you know, if I were you, you sort of get something.
Oh, well, they
behind.
Don't like the term Mohammedan either, so hey.
Well, no, that's very true. But although a lot of people identify, or a lot of people who don't really understand the differences between the sects,
mm-hmm.
they think that Wahhabism
right.
is identical to Salafism. It's not exactly.
No, it's not.
They do share some texts, and they, in
well,
particular, they do
they're,
reference
they're
some
both,
of the works.
Tim, they're both purist sects.
Yeah.
And that they want to follow the true word of Muhammad, and that Muslims, pray for their souls, have to follow the purest sense of the evil green book, the Quran. And, the Salafis and the Wahhabis, they are purists. And
yes,
when we find other sects that come out like the Ahmadiyya, they're considered heretics.
Yes, indeed. And I've got a distinction here between Wahhabism and Salafism, which I'll briefly read it out, because the distinction's quite subtle. And this particular quotation comes from a chap called Stéphane Lacroix, who was a lecturer in a university in Paris, but he said that Salafism, as opposed to Wahhabism, refers to hybridations that have taken place since the 1960s between the teachings of Muhammad mm-hmm. bin Abd al-Wahhab and other Islamic schools of thought. So what he's talking about is that Muhammad bin Abd al-Wahhab developed a line of thought which was quite distinct from the other Islamic schools of thought, the other madhab, like the four Sunni schools of jurisprudence, for example, which we can touch on later.
Mm-hmm.
The teachings of Muhammad bin Abd al-Wahhab were quite distinct, but Salafis still, although they do reference these works, they do make a lot of distinctions, and they don't like to be called Wahhabis. Their approach, puritanical though it is, and Wahhabism is puritanical, there are those differences. There are, again, there's some references which I will dig out and stick in the chat room before the end of the show. But it's interesting insofar as it does have relevance to what's happening in the world today, particularly in the light of the Arab Spring and the countries in North Africa and the Middle East that are in conflict today.
I think this is something, the underlying, I say underlying, but I'm more inclined in my head to say the nefarious underbelly of Islam, the ramifications behind Islam, and all of these sectors that have developed, and never mind the infighting, Tim, but it's these developments that it's like they are trying to top themselves in how they can accomplish defeating the infidel. And this particular one that you're relating, it's unbelievable to me. It's unbelievable. And you were referring to the Egyptian armed forces. And, of course, they threw over Morsi there, and they – They put in this what was his name? General Abdel Al-Sisi.
Al-Sisi, yeah. Sorry, go on.
Nobody liked that, and I thought that Abdel Sisi was actually working for the people, and they get all these infiltrators in there, and they get Al Qaeda involved in fighting this, and this is all coming back to bite Barack Hussein Obama. He started all this in the Middle East, and he's reawakening all these factions.
He's got blood on his hands, no doubt about that. Now, you would think that somebody who assumes the mantle of a great world leader would do what he could to foster international relations that were going to be to the benefit of the United States. And once you'd taken care of doing everything you could for the benefit of the United States, because that's one of the reasons you're elected president, I imagine, in my naivety. That's one of the reasons. You would then try and do the greatest good that you could for other people in the world, whilst not endangering or unduly endangering American interests. But Barack Obama, being who he is, he's taken the wrong decision at every turn, and it's quite clear that he supports the Muslim Brotherhood. People have often asked me, is Barack Hussein Obama a Muslim? And I say, well, he says he isn't, but what you've got to say to yourself is, if he was a Muslim, would he be doing anything different? And I would say probably not.
Well, he's anti-colonialist, that's for sure. He is a Muslim by birthright because he was born of a Muslim father. Whether or not he denounced his Islamic birthright and embraced Christianity, that's up to anybody's guess. I don't know. But yes, it's like you and me. If we were born of a Jewish mother, we would be Jewish by birthright. Barack Hussein Obama, yes, is a Muslim by birthright. And my goodness sake,
Again, this is a topic where we could take up a whole show over discussing his origins and his affiliations and his what he has planned. But I think it's only fair to say at the moment that it's quite obvious that he tried to support the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and was enraged when it was toppled by General Al-Sisi, to the point where he said, right, if you don't return the Muslim Brotherhood to power, we're going to stop all the aid. And it's quite a large amount of aid. It's, billions of dollars a year to Egypt and to the Egyptian military.
That's right.
He said, right, we're going to stop all that. Now, I don't know exactly where he's got up to in that process, whether the aid's been stopped or what. But he was obviously very supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood, and then the Salafist movement that was behind it.
I like what Bigfoot just said in the chat room. I don't think Obama is a Muslim or a Christian. He just worships himself.
Yeah,
and Bigfoot is so totally correct. He's right, this guy is so hedonistic, this unbelievably unreal when it comes to his ego knows no bounds. I'm almost leaning towards that. He is following into the footsteps of a Muslim who thinks so highly of themselves. Oh my gosh. But I'm not going there. I don't want to go there.
Muslim.
I like what Bigfoot said. He does. The guy's a sociopath, I think.
I was just having a little chuckle at that. A Muslim that thinks highly of himself. Heaven forbid that there is such a thing.
I know.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
No kidding. But, oh my goodness, I can't believe the time is going so very fast. We have 15 minutes of our talking point left, but we have been discussing, Ken of the Exceptional Conservative, Obama is the Pharaoh. Oh gosh, bless you folks, thank you. But we have been discussing the issues of the different sectors of Islam. We have been concentrating on the major ones, but folks, there are 73 sectors of Islam out there. And what Tim and myself want you to do is go out there and explore for yourself. But what Tim and I strive to do, and I hope we did it justice, is please understand Sunni, Shiite in particular, and the Sufi, and the Salafis, and the Wahhabis sects, because that is what's really motivating Islam today. Wouldn't you agree with that, Tim? Tim? Oh, no. I think I lost my co-host. Okay.
Hang on. Am I back? Am I back?
You're back.
Can you hear me? Oh, good.
I can hear you.
That was my fault. Sorry about that. What I was going to say was, when you're talking about Islam to other people, whether it's colleagues at work or people within your family or people mm-hmm. at your church or whatever, a lot of people will say, well, you know, Islam is not monolithic, and you can say, yes, I know, there are these different sects. And hopefully we've given
That's
you
right.
a little bit of insight that you can use to talk to people about it. But what's most important is that you can say to them that even though there are these sects, what you have to remember is that when it comes to fighting the infidel, Muslims will band together, and the sects then become irrelevant. And when we are looking to beat the scourge, as I hope we all are, then you have to realise that when people say, "Oh, you can't treat Islam like that because it's not a big monolithic thing," you have to bear that in mind, that they will all join together when it comes to fighting the infidel. And another thing, of course, is when our politicians say to us that we cannot deal with Islam effectively because there are all these different sects, and although there might be one or two extremists amongst the Islamic community, it's unfair to tar all Muslims with the same brush. Well, excuse me, we have a huge problem here of global proportions, and if we start splitting hairs between the Muslim sects when it comes to fighting the Islamic scourge, we will not be able to take any effective action at all. And effective action is something that must be taken if we're going to avoid civil war in the very near future. So we have to acknowledge that there are differences, but we also have to acknowledge that the threat of the Islamic scourge supersedes those differences, mm-hmm. and that Muslims themselves will put aside those differences when it comes to fighting the mm-hmm. infidel. And you have to also remember that Islam is always in the position of fighting the infidel. The Islamic ideology tells devout Muslims that is what they must do. Islamic ideology, as I'm sure our listeners know, divides the world into two parts. There is Darul Islam, lands that are ruled by Islam, and there is Darul Harb, which are lands that are not
absolutely.
Ruled by Islam. Darul Harb actually stands for lands of war, and the implication is that it's every devout Muslim's duty to fight the infidel in whatever way they can, big or small, whether it's by the sword or by the pen or through any little act, however big or small, in order to turn the lands of Darul Harb into lands ruled by Islam. That is the goal of every devout Muslim. And you have to remember that Muslims will put aside their differences in order to accomplish that goal. So the fact
and
that we're talking
thing,
about...
And one thing, too, is that we have been discussing some of the major sections of Islam. We got to be careful. Major sects? Okay. I'm not having major sects with Islam, ladies and gentlemen, and certainly Tim is not either. But we have discussing the major sects of Islam, and one thing that we hope that you understand is that Islam is infighting. They're infighters. They're infighters with these sects. They, we have discussed the Shia and the Sunni. They cannot decide upon themselves even who should be a successor successor from when Muhammad died. Okay, guys, get this through to your intellectual reading. Muhammad died in the year
632.
Muhammad passed away. The guy did not even leave a will as to who would be his successor. So these guys have been battling about it amongst themselves ever since. But what they're doing, and what Tim just related to you, Dar El Harb, that is us, and you know what? They're here, and they're willing and able to conquer us unless we stand up and put an end to it. Right, Tim?
That is absolutely right. And the first step in standing up and putting an end to it is understanding the enemy we are up against. Now, our mm-hmm. political elites and our mainstream media are pushing us not to understand the problem. They are trying to say that Islam is a benign and tolerant religion of peace. Well, we know it isn't. We can see in everything that happens around the world every day with what Muslims do in the name of Islam, to call it a benign and tolerant religion of peace induces a certain cognitive dissonance. And when people wonder why that is, we, that is you and I, Kel, and the listeners on this show, can stand up and tell them, because we are much better informed than they are. And the first thing we have to do is to make all our compatriots in Western countries who are affected by this scourge in the same way that we are, we have to make them aware
Absolutely.
Of it. Most people out there know that there's something wrong, but they don't really know how to express it. They know it's something to do mm-hmm. with Islam, but it's a big, huge, scary subject, and they're not always sure how they should approach it or what could be done, if anything. And there's far too many people out there who are willing to say either there's nothing that can be done, or that we shouldn't attack Islam unfairly because it's just a handful of extremists. Neither of those things are true. And if we truly understand Islam and can make that widely known to the point where we can get a critical mass of people sufficiently knowledgeable to overturn the existing political structure and to install politicians who really understand what the problem is, we do have a chance to turn that whole thing around. Now, it might be a big ask. It might seem a big ask at this moment, but you know, stranger things have happened, and we have a window of opportunity before demographics overtake us. So I'm very hopeful.
We do. And I was listening to your program on Liberty GB the other day, Tim, and the point that you brought up and Paul Weston brought up, and that was exactly, the demographics. The demographics, if we do not rein it in, we're going to lose. Because it's not just the population. It's the ideology that are instilled in these families that have maybe 4 children or 9 children. We are not having the amount of children that the Muslims are having. They're in here. They're in our Western countries, and they're having children exponentially above us, and they are instilling ideologies. And Tim, that's what we have to combat. That is the threat, is the demographics. Absolutely.
Well, we do indeed, and you always have to bear in mind when you talk to people about this and they say, well, you know, Islam is just another set of ideas. It is a set of ideas. It's true. The Islamic ideology is a set of ideas, but we have a better set of ideas. Our set of ideas, if you like, our Judeo-Christian values and traditions are superior to anything Islam has produced to date, or anything that Islam is likely to produce in the foreseeable future. And we should never lose sight of that. When people say, it's all relative, and there's nothing, you know, Christians did bad things as well, and so on and so on and so on. Just remember that everything we see around us today, everything that we have built up because of our Judeo-Christian values. They may not be mm-hmm. perfect. No man-made system ever is. But
absolutely
it's a dance.
I can agree with
anything.
That, yeah.
It's better than anything Islam has to offer at any time now or in the future. And we should never lose sight of that. Islam is an inferior culture. It's based on an inferior set of values, and we should not be afraid to stand up and say so. And anybody who wants to argue it coming from the point of view of multiculturalism, we should just stand up and call BS, basically. Just say that is bullshit. We have a superior way of doing things.
It frustrates me because why are we afraid to stand up to this ideology? It's a threatening ideology. I brought this up earlier, and the listeners say, I sound like a broken record, but for goodness sake, they do have a track record of civilization jihad. The kinetic jihad, okay, maybe that's something we can deal with, but is it going to take more kinetic jihad before the lesser jihad, before people start to realize that the greater jihad is here? And I don't looking into one soul and finding peace. That, like the Islamists will say that. No, in my eyes, the greater jihad is been totally retarded in that they are engaging in the civilization jihad. Tim, my gosh.
Yeah. You've got to remember that when it comes to jihad, I mean, a lot of people will say Muslims will tell them that jihad is an interior spiritual struggle, and of course it does have that meaning. But when you look at how that compares with the jihad of actually physically fighting the infidel on a battlefield, not necessarily hand-to-hand combat, but physically fighting. The jihad in that case refers to that course of action about 97% of the time. Certainly, if you're comparing it to how many times that word is used in Islamic texts, whereas the interior spiritual struggle is only referred to in about 3% of the cases.
Yeah.
So, although it does have that meaning, the primary meaning is fighting the infidel in order to turn the lands of Dar al-Harb into Dar al-Islam. But we should never forget that we do have a superior system, a superior narrative, I would say. And we have the tools in order to get that knowledge out there. And most importantly, when you asked it, why don't people seem to wake up a little bit more? There's three reasons in my view. One is they're too comfortable. We have been in most Western countries for most of the past 70 odd years, ever since World War II. We have by and large become very prosperous and very comfortable, and most people don't want to jeopardize that. And if they're told that speaking out about things like Islam could be seen as reflecting badly on their job or reduce their standing in the eyes of their friends, well, it's a natural human reaction, maybe just to keep your head down, keep quiet, just keep putting a roof over the heads of your family, keep food on the table, not to say too much to rock the boat. But sooner or later, if anybody does that, it's all going to be taken away from
him.
So
oh,
that's
my
one
goodness.
Thing.
That could be another Monday topic.
What I was going to round off by saying was that's one of the reasons. The second reason is the political correctness and multiculturalism, which has been instilled into a great deal of us in the past 40 years. Not you and I, Kel. We're past that, and I'm sure most of our listeners as well have realised that the political correctness and multiculturalism ethos. Has been thoroughly discredited. And although there are people that still cling to it and are still trying to push forward the fact that one culture is the same as another, we are here to tell you that that isn't true, ladies and gentlemen. Our culture is superior, and we should never be afraid to stand up and say so. So that's two reasons. And the third reason is that it is a big, scary subject. And when I was talking to a psychologist friend of mine, he said the best way to tackle a big, scary subject is in the same way as you would eat an elephant. And I said, how do you mean? He says, when you're eating an elephant, and you first start, it looks like a big, great big scary thing. But when you take it one little mouthful at a time, pretty soon, if you take lots of little tiny mouthfuls, and you maybe get people to come and help you, and they all take little mouthfuls at a time, pretty soon you can eat that elephant. And that's what we should be doing. We're eating the elephant one little bit at a time. And I find that's a really good analogy. And that's what I'd like to round up with. Don't be afraid of it, ladies and gentlemen. It is big and scary on the surface, but it's an elephant, and it can be eaten one little mouthful at a time.
Tim? Once again, we had a banner show. I am so grateful that I can, ladies and gentlemen, that I can have one of the most wonderful voices sharing with you on the Red Fox Blogger. And this is Tim's show, too. And I just want to apprise you of that. We are out of time, though. And I want to remind you, though, next week, we have the Christmas special, and the week after that, we have the New Year's Eve special. So the Red Fox Blogger is going to be getting all quite Christmassy. Tim and myself, we want to thank you for being here. Right, Tim?
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us. Hopefully you've been able to take something away with that. And, of course, if you've got any queries at all, you can get in touch with Kel, or you can get in touch with me either on my Twitter feed at followthecat at catstrangler101, or you can actually email me, because I'm going to put my email address out here.
Oh, you know what, Tim? All your links are in the show notes.
Oh, they are.
Archive
okay.
Listeners, you can find that. But Tim and myself, we really appreciate the people that visited our chat room. We had people pop in and out. We have Bigfoot and we have some guests that were here. Golf Dogs, Rock and Ron, Lucha, Dora, Mama, Mia, Baby, you are one warrior princess at the Radio Jihad Network, Wednesday nights at 6 p.m. Reem Soldier, the exceptional conservative who has a show tonight at 9 p.m., as a matter of fact. So you make sure that you check those shows out. I want to thank Sue from New Mexico for calling in, and I want to thank Rooster as well for calling in. And I keep saying It's not your show, Kel. It's Tim's and Kel's show. We want to thank you.
Oh, well, Kel, no, I have to give you credit where it's due. I was looking at the various show statistics which are available to Blog Talk Radio hosts. And ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you that Kel is the either the host or the co-host on three of the very top shows in the category, political conservative category on Blog Talk Radio. So I think she deserves a round of applause just for that. Well done,
Tim, you're giving me
so there's not too many people who can do that all at the same time. So yeah, that's all in the same week. So well done, Kel.
Thank you, Tim. I will be Skyping with you later during the week so that we can go over the show notes for our Christmas special next Monday.
Excellent. Good. Look forward to it.
Okay. Tim, once again, what can I say? You're the best co-host a gal could ask for.
Well, that's very kind, and I'm not going to make any off-color jokes about the topic we've been talking about.
Absolutely.
I did all that at the start of the show. people will start talking about us.
I know, I got you. But ladies and gentlemen, we really do appreciate you being here tonight. We have been discussing very, very important topics, and Tim and myself, what we are doing is that we're offering you an insight, and we're hoping that you will do your homework. We want you to do your homework. Explore these sectors of Islam. The world's second largest so-called faith, okay? And it's not monolithic. It's not full of schisms. it's focusing first on disagreements over who should lead the new faith and later on matters of doctrine. But this is on our shores right now. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining Tim and myself. And remember, it is mass Islamity, and we have to stop the insanity. Have a great evening, and I will see you back here on Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Bye-bye.
Yeah, goodbye, everybody.
The kitty. Have a great week, everybody. See you back here at 7 p.m. on Friday. Bye-bye.